Well, impact geology concerns the effects of the bombardment of planets by meteorites and comets, which create cratered surfaces. If we look at the moon, we can see that the face of the moon is actually made up of very large impact structures, which were generated many billions of years ago by lights and comets hitting that planet. And we have evidence of impact structures on Earth too, and what we do is work as geologists on trying to understand how they were formed back in geological time and relating their structure and formation to what we see on other planets.
What got you interested in this field? What made you a crater man?
That's an interesting question. Well, when I came to Canada 26 years ago, I didn't know anything about impact craters, really, but I was a type of geologist called a metamorphic petrologist, which is very fancy. When I came here, one of the things that Canada is well endowed in is impact craters, because we have the Canadian Shield, which forms the core of our country, which comprises very, very old rocks. Not all rocks are old. Some are older than others, which people may not realize. What it means is the older you go, the further back you go in time, the more likely the geological terrain is to contain impact structures, because the rate of impact has decreased through time. So the further back you go in time, the more likely you are to see impact craters affecting the surface. So Canada actually has numerous impact craters. And where I came from, the UK, for example, doesn't have any. So when I studied in the UK, that wasn't a feature that we really dealt with. So when I came to Canada, it was clear there was this new and exciting area which hadn't really been studied in as much detail as we wanted and we needed to know more about this process. Also a time when, if you perhaps recall, back in the 1980s, we discovered the Chicxulub impact crater in the north of Mexico, which has been attributed to the demise of the dinosaurs. This is 65 million years ago, when a very large impact event occurred, which wiped out a lot of the species on Earth. So that discovery meant that people realized that geological processes weren't just slow and steady all the time and incremental, but we had catastrophes. One type of catastrophe, which is controlling evolution, is impact. So the whole community started to appreciate the importance of the impact process in terms of controlling the evolution of life on our planet and also modifying the surface. The geological community started to appreciate the importance of impact craters.
When you're studying craters, are you crawling around inside them and picking away at the rock?
Yes, in effect. What happens on Earth, because we have a dynamic planet which erodes rock away, many of the impact craters we study are already cut into, if you like, incised or unearthed or exhumed by natural processes. So when we walk around them on the surface now, we're actually walking inside what would have been their original structure, because the glaciation or rivers or various other processes have stripped away the topmost rocks. Sometimes we want to see those topmost rocks, but other times you want to see inside. So we can actually use different craters which are eroded to a different level to work out what's going on by combining all that information, if you see what I mean. So we do walk around inside them, in effect, but you know, we're actually walking on the surface of the Earth.
You've done a fair bit of work at the crater in Sudbury.
Yes, that's a good point, because there you can walk inside, because you can go into mines. And I was just thinking that as I finished my last sentence. The mining industry there has obviously extracted many millions of tons of copper and nickel deposits from that area for over a century now, and because of that there's an extensive mine network, and we're continuing to do work with INCO, actually, my group, and I've had several PhD students and master students go through working with industry, looking at that very large impact crater. We think it's probably the second largest we know of in the world. It was probably an asteroid that hit Sudbury. We don't really know whether it was an asteroid or a comet, but it was probably in the order of 20 kilometers in diameter and traveling probably around 15 to 20 kilometers per second. So that's a tremendous amount of energy, much more than the whole of the world's total nuclear arsenal, many times more than that.
So do you also look to the future? There's been a couple of movies, for example, that we worry about, well, when is the next asteroid going to hit the Earth?
Yes, there's Armageddon with Bruce Willis and Deep Impact, these sort of disaster movies. I think the probability of us being hit by a meteorite or comet is certainly there, and it will happen. The question is, how big will it be? We actually accumulate quite a lot of extraterrestrial material every year, but it's typically in the form of dust or very small particles. But you can get large ones coming through. We do try and track the asteroids. Right now, we do not have the technology to deflect. The problem is, you know, if we're going to develop technology for that, it would cost many billions and billions of dollars. And it's a probability game. The likelihood of another Chicxulub-type event, which would wipe out much of the life on the planet, is so low that any president who decided to invest billions of dollars in it at the expense of other social amenities would probably not get reelected or be fired. So it would be logical to develop a defense system, but I think it's probably not easy to do.
Now, along with the work that you're doing with craters that are here on Earth, you're also doing some work with the Europeans and also with NASA. What's happening there?
More so than Earth, the Moon in particular, and also Mars to a lesser extent, they are covered in impact craters. So their characters, if you like, are more dominated by the impact cratering process than Earth is. And that's because Earth is a bigger planet and is active. And it's actually destroyed a lot of its impact craters, particularly its early ones. However, the Moon retains its impact craters, and Mars does to a large extent too. So in terms of knowledge and understanding, it's relatively logical for them to come to our group here at the university to get expertise and access that experience of impact cratering. So what we've done is to apply our Earth-based knowledge to other planetary bodies like the Moon and Mars. And so we're working on Martian materials and also on lunar materials in terms of training students and doing research and publishing on that. We've just, for example, published a paper recently on some lunar rocks we've determined the age of, which are related to impact.
How old are they?
Well, most of them are around 4.1 billion. Which is very old, yeah. But that's not unusual for the Moon.
Well, if you look at rocks that are coming from Mars and those that you might find because of a crater on Earth, what would the difference be?
Well, that's a good question. The question is, in a way, how do you know if you have a lump of stone on the ground whether it's from Mars or not? Martian meteorites are relatively rare. We have about 40 of them now. Altogether, there is a list that's kept on the web of Martian meteorites, and it's continually growing. Most of the Martian meteorites come from desert situations, such as the North African desert, because the meteorites are normally black, and the deserts are pale beige color, so you can actually see them very clearly. Now, we don't know whether they're Martian or not, but there are a number of collectors out there who go out into these deserts and pick up these distinct stones and bring them back, and then they're analyzed to determine which planetary body they came from. The same goes for Antarctica, where the action of glaciers and ice movement concentrates these black bodies at the edges of retreating glaciers. And so you have a whole line of meteorites that get sort of dumped at the edge of the meteorite as it retreats, and they're black on white, so they're very easy to pick up. That's not to say that North Africa or Antarctica have any more necessarily than anywhere else on the planet. It's just that we can see them more easily. I'm still questioning, how do we distinguish a Martian fragment from any other rock or any other planetary body? When NASA had two very successful missions, Viking 1 and Viking 2 in the 1970s, where they sent two landers down to the surface, they also analyzed the Martian atmosphere. And when we analyze trapped gases inside certain meteorites, we find that the gas composition matches exactly the atmospheric composition for Mars. That's the main evidence. The other thing is, if we determine the geological age of these samples, they're typically very young. They're 600 million years or less than a billion years. If we date a typical meteorite from the asteroid belt, that they would normally have the same age as the solar system's star, which is 4.6 billion. So when we have very young rocks from another planet, it means the planet has been making younger rocks for a long time, if you think about it. It's been active. We know the moon is pretty much dead, so it eliminates the moon, and it points to it being a larger planet, and Mars is twice the diameter of the moon. So it points towards Mars, and then we have the trapped gas evidence from Viking, and then you put the two together, and it means you have a larger planet, and it's Mars.
Well, if we can get these rocks from Mars, they're hitting here and landing on Earth. Are there bits of Earth that are heading off into space and landing somewhere else?
Absolutely, because planets exchange material by the impact process. They also blast off material that's lofted off the surface, and these fragments can reach escape velocity and leave that planetary body, and then they get into space, and they hang around there, and then they're subject to the vagaries of gravitational fields of other planets, so if they wander around for long enough, they get sucked into a planet's gravity field, they'll land on the surface. So undoubtedly, there will be pieces of Sudbury on the moon, and I expect Sudbury on Mars. Again, it's going to be a very small percentage of those planets, right? So the likelihood of you picking up a piece of Sudbury on the moon is very, very low, but it's, nevertheless, they're going to be there. So we exchange planetary materials. And then some scientists have extended that further and said we can exchange life by the same process. And some people have even gone as far to suggest that certain bacteria may have developed on Mars before it ever developed on Earth, and that those meteorites lofted off Mars that came to Earth may have actually been the seeds for life here. Because Earth, being a bigger planet, may have been less hospitable earlier on. It may have been too hot, too active, too inhospitable for life. Whereas Mars, being half the diameter of the Earth, was able to perhaps sustain the development of life before here on Earth, in which case we're Martians. Anyway, that's just conjectural. It's not proven, of course. But the notion is this: it's called panspermia, where scientists are suggesting that life actually travels through meteoritic or cometary material, actually even from outside our solar system.
You have to wonder then how those seeds of life could even withstand the harsh conditions of space.
Yes, and people have done tests. They've actually impacted and put shockwaves through materials with primitive bacteria attached, and found that certain bacteria can become dormant. They don't need any sort of support. They don't need air. They can be in a vacuum, they could be frozen, they can be heated fairly substantially, and they'll survive. Now, it's not proven that that's what's happened, but it's a suggestion, and I think it's an interesting one.
What do you think the work that you're doing means to our everyday life?
Well, the subject of impact is, I think, highly relevant to everyday life, because we travel in cars, which go at relatively high speed. We travel in aircraft from A to B. And we also have various defense applications where high-speed impact needs to be mitigated by the development of, for example, armor and shielding technologies. So one of our research developments of our group is to transform our knowledge of natural impact and shock damage by the high-speed impact of meteorites and comets into trying to understand how to design materials that are impact-resistant.
Dr. Spray, you're also involved in a couple of missions, going to Mars, I believe. What's involved there?
Well, there are two missions, one led by the European Space Agency, which is called ExoMars, and the other led by NASA, which is called the Mars Science Laboratory, MSL. And both these involve the deployment of rovers on the surface of Mars, and both of which have as one of their primary objectives the testing and exploration for life on Mars. This is one of the, I would say, outstanding fundamental issues of current times, trying to determine whether life can have evolved and have existed or even still exists on planet. And Mars is a very good contender for this, because we believe it had suitable conditions, at least in the geological past, for life to thrive. So these two rovers, which are quite different in their design, one is bigger than the other. One, in fact, the NASA one is about the size of a small car. It's probably one of the largest vehicles to be deployed on Mars. That will be moving around, exploring, sampling rocks, analyzing them, working out the geology of Mars, what it's made of, and also assessing potential sites that may have been suitable for harboring life forms. Now, we're not expecting to see any advanced life forms or evidence of past life forms that were advanced, but rather We're looking at bacteria or very primitive type of organisms that may have interacted with minerals and rock and left their signature cryptically on the surface or just below the surface of the planet. So these are two very exciting missions. Our role is to provide geological, mineralogical insight and to help with, in the first case, vision systems, interpreting geological textures so that we can understand what the cameras see in terms of science know-how, determining rock types, and also we'll be helping to interpret geochemical data from one of the analytical tools led by Canada, the APXS analyzer, which is an alpha particle X-ray spectrometer.
And when will those take place?
Well, MSL is scheduled to be launched next year, 2009, and ExoMars 2011, but I think the ExoMars one may be pushed back a little bit, and we have to remember it takes a while to get to Mars, so we're looking at typically 12 to 18 months period flight time. So the actual deployment on the surface will be a little bit later, but the launch dates are 2009 for the NASA mission, and right now it's still being looked at as 2011 for the ExoMars mission.
Thank you very much, Dr. Spray.
Hey, my pleasure.